The following program was produced by the Circle A Radio Collective in Portland, Oregon.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and all you white people too. Occupation of the Rock was intended to draw to public attention the inadequacy of concern for the plight of the Indian people and the refusal or inability of the federal government to recognize Indians as citizens and human beings. Alcatraz is not only an island, it's a catalyst. It's tied between the past and the future. It's an unseen movement. It's a purpose. And the purpose is that the Indians are people to be reckoned with. We have a lot of cliches in this country. Some of them go like this. White is right. Black is beautiful. Well, let me add one more. Indians are permanent.
The United States government abandoned the island of Alcatraz in San Francisco Bay in 1963. On March 8, 1964, a small group of Sioux attempted to take the island, invoking the 1868 Treaty of Fort Laramie. The treaty promised the Sioux surplus federal land, but it was clear that the Sioux had no ancestral claims as far west as San Francisco. They lasted a few hours on the island, singing and drumming, before U.S. Marshals ushered them off. They had made their point, though, and the idea of reclaiming Alcatraz as Indian land stuck in the minds of many. The occupation began on November 20, 1969. At about 2 a.m., nearly 80 American Indians from more than 20 tribes pulled up to the island's eastern shore in three boats, and the island of Alcatraz was occupied until June 11, 1971. Tonight on Circle A Radio, we talk to Robert Free Galvin and Lenny Foster, veterans of the Alcatraz movement. We'll also hear audio from Indian Land Radio and other recordings made during the occupation.
It's 1492 to the present, November 9th, 1969. The Indian people have been held in bondage. Alcatraz was released from that bondage.
My name is Lenny Foster. I'm a Diné from Fort Defiance, Arizona. I'm Kiaani, born for Tsetlani, and my Chays are Tropahe, and my Nalis are Anahuani. And I work for the Navajo Nation Corrections Project at this time. For the last 27 years, I've been the program supervisor for the Corrections Project. My work takes me into the state prisons and federal penitentiaries throughout Western United States. I have over 2,000 brothers and sisters as clients and patients, and I visit 96 correctional facilities.
My name is Robert Free Galvin, and I'm a Tewa Scottish-Mexican human rights activist advocate for decades. I had already been politicalized, I guess, way before Alcatraz. I had started to become involved in the civil rights movements, the anti-war protest movements. Had gone to Washington, D.C. at 17 to encircle the Pentagon and try and shut it down. And the other thing I'd done that was political, I guess, was the Poor People's Campaign that went to Washington, D.C., thousands and thousands of people, and encamped there for a couple of weeks in the mud. So that was just a part and continuation of a journey when Richard Oakes and some other students from the Bay Area occupied the island of Alcatraz and opened the door for many disenfranchised people and became a gathering place to find strength amongst each other and to refine and sophisticate our language of the politics. But it was a good pit stop there, Alcatraz. Yeah.
How old were you when you went to Alcatraz?
By that time, I must have been 20.
Well, in 1969, there was a real social unrest, social upheaval throughout this country, and the American Indian was part of that revival of culture and tradition and spirituality, a return to our way of life. And I was no different. And I was 21 years old at the time, and I was searching for a spiritual identity. And when I heard about the American Indians occupying Alcatraz Island, I decided to hitchhike out there from Fort Collins, Colorado. And I was a junior in college at Colorado State University, and I hitchhiked during the Christmas break out to Alcatraz Island, San Francisco Bay Area. And for me, it was a spiritual pilgrimage. I was seeking an identity as an American Indian, and I wanted to see what that was all about. And when I arrived there, I met some people who I had known in my youth, Pat Genia from the Tisto Pinon area. Howard Naz and Glenn McLemore were a couple of high school kids who had left school and made it out to San Francisco, and they were from my hometown of Fort Defiance, and I ran into them. I found that the occupation was the remedy or seeking compliance and enforcement of treaty rights. Basically, it came down to this piece of island that was abandoned by the federal government, who was going to revert back to the Indian people based on provisions in the 1868 treaties. Any federal lands that were used by the government, that were taken by the government and was no longer being used, would be automatically revert back to the Indian people. So that was on that claim that the occupation began.
Originally, I went on there, and we started to sleep in the different cells inside the prison. Of course, we had no heating. We were making our own heating and to electrical appliances or wood stoves. But then I got a teepee. I picked a spot where the only place they allowed prisoners to do gardening. So there's this place on the cliff overlooking the city and Golden Gate. And in this cliff, it was surrounded with beautiful flowers and bushes, and just at the edge was all these seals at the bottom. So it's a very hard, cold place, Alcatraz, and I found that to be more what I was seeking, more quiet and peaceful. So I put a teepee up there, and of course it's very visual, so everybody who came to the island would eventually come up to the teepee. And me and a buddy, Louis Mitchell, who was a Mohawk from Akwesasne, we stayed there and endured there for about 9 months. But we go off the island, of course, and we go visiting. We had a boat that was donated to us by Clearwater Revival.
Oh, really?
Because one of the Indians that was from actually Washington State. Anyways, he had been in Vietnam with that leader of that band, John Fogerty or something like that. And they were all war buddies in the trenches. So when he got out, and then they all found each other again, he found out his buddy was on Alcatraz. He asked him, "Hey, what can I do? What can I help? Can I do anything for you?" He goes, "Yeah, we need a boat, because we had to transport our supplies from Fisherman's Wharf back to the island." So they bought at that time, big time money, $10,000 boat. And we got this sea captain guy to train some Indians to be pilots and captains, and that became our supply relay from the island to the mainland, and transporting people back and forth.
When I was doing a little research about this, I'd read about there was the teepee there, and no matter what the storms were and the weather being really extreme on Alcatraz, that the teepee never fell down and was always really symbolic.
We put a little wood burner in there, and we would wrap up that teepee when the storms came, and somehow that we'd stay warm in there. But teepees aren't made to be in the wet environment, weather like that. You know, the Ohlone Indians and all the other Indians that are from California and on the coast, they would have these cedar log homes that were halfway in the ground, and this teepee would get very cold, wet, damp inside. after that little wood stove we had really would dry it up. But the winds would fill the teepee up with air and then flap back down. It was really loud during the storms. And I had anchored it with some huge long rope from the top down to the bottom with a huge iron bar in there. So that's why it really stuck.
Creedence Clearwater Revival was who donated the expensive boat, but as far as day-to-day expenses.
Again, there was an Indian that was Joe Morris and the Blackfeet from Montana, Blackfeet from the res over there, who was a member of the Longshoremen's. And he got in front of his monthly meeting with the Longshoremen's, and he challenged the union to be supportive of the Alcatraz occupation by donating a depot, a pier, where they could receive supplies and store supplies. And the union donated the pier down there near the ferry building, and that became our Alcatraz depot and would be the receiving point for donations, food, clothing, things like that. People donated there that way and other ways with money. People were very supportive. We also had, when there was the blockade, there's a lot of people that came forward with their boats and brought us water when they shut off the water on the island. As a way to force Indians off, they shut off the electricity, the water supply, and we had to somehow try and survive. They were going to use the excuse that there was the lighthouse needed electricity, but because of the occupation, they were going to have to assault the island and remove us because they needed the lighthouse. So a friend of ours, Herbie Butler from Alaska, Athabascan from Fairbanks, he was an electrician, so he went up there and somehow rigged up a generator and got that lighthouse working, and that blew the government's excuse of why to throw us off. So we set up electricity on the island, and water was reinstituted because of the human rights, I guess, and public outrage of that they were going to thirst the Indians out. People would donate little milk bottles of water. This was before water was being sold in bottles, right? So they would fill up containers and bring it to the island.
That was Robert Free Galvin, and this is an unnamed Pacifica reporter on Alcatraz.
A large number of Native Americans are now gathering around a piece of leather that's been stretched on four stakes, which has a proclamation on it. I'm sure they'll be reading that sometime later. The proclamation, of course, declares that this is their land, and despite anything the government may want to do, they are going to retain their land and they're going to remain here. I noticed earlier that there was an army helicopter traveling over the island and circling it once to check things out, but apparently there's been no attempt today to really affect the activities here. In the past few days, however, the Coast Guard has turned off the electricity and discontinued the use of the lighthouse on the island, as well as taking away a water barge which supplied the island with water. So the Coast Guard has been in the area and has affected life here. Everybody was asked to try to bring their own water and their own supplies if they could, and we did so. There's no electricity, so everything on the island is being, all the electricity that's powered by generators is used very sparingly, only for the essential things, cooking mostly.
Now I'd like to introduce Della Leach, council member from the island.
First, I'd like to welcome all of our friends that have come at our invitation, especially to the ones that have supported us, the black organizations, Chicano organizations, the Women's Jewish League, and all the other Jewish foundations, the Asian League, of which the Japanese people have been the most generous because they themselves know what we have gone through. They are celebrating, if you might say it that, this Memorial Day that you people celebrate. This is the anniversary of the order for the Japanese people to evacuate the coast. So on this day, our heart goes out to the Japanese people. and our thanks go out to them for their generous offerings to us here on Alcatraz. If you do not want to be the ugly American that you have made of yourself throughout the world, then the one thing that you can do today is to stop this genocide. Stop it by contacting every one of your politicians, sending them word that you back the Indians on Alcatraz, that you back the Indians wherever they might be, and whatever problem they may face. This genocide will stop. We will not permit it. The BIA says there's only about 700,000 of us left. The anthropologists tell us that there are close to 2 million of us. We know how many of us there are. You have divided us by lines, geographically. You have put us in urban areas. You have disbanded us, terminated us, starved us, killed us. But we are here. Every one of us are here. Because in our religion, there is no ending of us. We are children of nature, and we go back to nature. So our people still exist here. Every blade of grass and every tree that grows is a part of us. We will not permit this genocide. If it takes violence, it will come from the white man. It will not come from us. But here on Alcatraz, we intend to stay. Because this genocide will stop with Alcatraz. Because this day forward, there is nowhere for the Indian to go but forward. He's been held back long enough. The genocide continues. Each and every one of us that have remained here on Alcatraz know what dangers we have been faced with. We have had boats come by and shoot at us. We've had foul words yelled at us. We've been accused by the government of obstructing navigation by dismantling the foghorns. These were gross lies. Our people did not do any of these things. But the genocide continues. If he can impress upon you that we have done these things upon this island, this will give him permission to come in and create violence against us. On December the 4th, I made the statement publicly that if they wanted another wounded knee on Alcatraz, our people would give it to them. Because passively, we are here on Alcatraz to stay. And the genocide will stop.
That was Stella Leach. And now back to Lenny Foster.
And also there were plans to turn the island into an educational center for all American Indians throughout the country, where the culture, the beliefs, the practices, the way of life could be retaught, the languages would be taught, ceremonies would be held, and it would be a center where education, tradition, and all of that would be incorporated into a curriculum where we would once relearn our way of life. So it was a very ambitious initiative, but of course the federal government with its government forces came down pretty hard, and it was an 18-month occupation. And in the process of that time, I made a visit out there twice and spent some time in the island. And you know, I was out there in the winter time, and it was very, very cold, and you had to survive. But it was just like any Indian reservation in the winter time, where sometimes we don't have adequate heating. We have to cut firewood to heat our homes, or you know, cook on. And we had to haul water because we didn't have any indoor plumbing. Things like that. You know, myself, I grew up like that in my grandparents' sheep camp. So it wasn't really a hardship, but for many, it was.
Robert Free Galvin.
Daily life was start with food and shelter and stuff. And the women really took control of that. And the men were like slave labor, so to speak, hauling all this supplies. You had to take it from the bottom of the island up to the main prison. And the guys helped in the kitchen, too, but it was mostly women that organized that part. And then there's security and all these guys. We were always just thinking we're going to get assaulted, so we had different things on the island to defend ourselves. The amount of people varied, of course. At the beginning, we had thousands of people would come in for different occasions, and as time drifted on into the, you know, this is 19-month occupation, you know, the numbers started to dwindle, and that was for various reasons. You also have to remember that Alcatraz was a focal point for everybody that felt disenfranchised or felt alone in their community to want to create change. They would come to the island. They would meet in the teepee or other places, and they would talk with other bros and sisters there about their problems back on their res. And then they would ask for support. Very few people know that there was actually like a strike force of Alcatraz bunch, group, society, brotherhood, sisterhood, that were the frontline people that would go to support different tribes and were prepared to do the frontline action of confrontation. Of course, that usually startled the communities who were feeling threatened to their funding sources. The government's going to cut our supplies off or our food if we rebel against them. You know, they're still recouping from last 50 years or 100 years of that kind of action from the government when you resist. So that's always an issue in a community. But the Alcatraz bunch was asked to go up to Pitt River land occupations that same year, 1970, or to go over to Rattlesnake Island in Pomo Country, or to go up to, and we were called Indians of All Tribes. That's all we call ourselves. The occupation was Indians of All Tribes. Somebody incorporated and said United Indians of All Tribes. You hear that group up in Seattle. But the original occupiers of Fort Lawton were the Indians of Alcatraz supporting the local Indians there. Later, you had the people from the fishing rights struggles in the Northwest come down and ask for help. So because of Alcatraz, you had a lot of actions occurring across the country, all the way up to Canada. We went up to Canada, the Alcatraz bunch, the Indians of All Tribes. And nobody put a tag on themselves, and hardly anybody knows about this, but they were the frontline people.
You know, it's really surprising to a lot of us who are in our late 20s or early 30s, the number of occupations that were going on in the late 60s and 70s?
Close to 200.
Could you maybe give us an idea about what the times were like in the late 60s, early 70s?
Well, this country is a redneck, a racist country till this day. You have the semblance of integration, but the reality is that it's still a racist country. You have the semblance of solidarity and collaboration, but in the reality, you find that most of the NGOs, most of the progressive groups are literally white-dominated, and the politics are white-privileged, antagonized as a barrier to real hearing out other people that aren't. And so at that time, taking on that whole blatant racist society was one where you could die more readily than you can today. So it was a different bravery and a different desperation that was at hand at that time. Nowadays, a lot of people have been bought off with the minimum of food stamps. You can't have a revolution on a full stomach, but on an empty one, you have a lot of converts. So right now, it's hard to get people to do anything. You know, you got everybody so segmented. Either in politics, you know, everybody does either just environmental or they'll do a health issue. At that time, we were doing the whole thing. You only had three channels on TV. It was easier to get everybody to focus on things. You can't get people to focus on anything now. They're all so scattered. That's how it was back then for me and other folks. It was quite a challenge, scary, and we found bravery and strength through a lot of our elders and a lot of the spiritual people that started to come out of the woodwork who had maintained resistance, the continuation of the resistance since Columbus set here, and found it still out there. It's more hidden again nowadays as opportunity has arisen out of all this initial efforts you have for Indian people, the Indian Self-Determination Act that allowed people to do economic independence, where they're doing casinos now. I hate to say it like that, but it came out of the movement. The Indian Education Act came out of that movement. The Indian Child Welfare Act came out of that movement. The Indian Health Care Act came out of that. All these acts came out of the knee-jerk reaction of this Congress to look like they were concerned before the world. Got the world's attention was the uniqueness of Indians taking over Alcatraz.